Mujtaba Khamenei was injured. Believe me, if you are running an insurance company, I won't advise you to do a life insurance on his head. It's AI, it's missiles, it's swarms, it's robotics, it's many, 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 many things. But it mostly, as I said before, operational, political, and intelligence capabilities, all together, the cooperation between US and Israel, as you said, unprecedented. It's never before. A real victory is by making the Iranian people going to the streets and replacing their regime, their leadership. It cannot be done by US or Israel. It must be done by the Iranian people.
Lav, it's great to see you and it's great to be back. How are you doing?
It has been quite the week and a half.
How's your family holding up? How are you holding up going down to the... You've had a lot more sirens than we have had in Jerusalem.
I don't know if it's a lot more, but there's a website now where you can like check how many hours you've spent in bomb shelter since the start of the war. So yesterday it was 18 hours. So I didn't check today.
I think there's also one that says like, when you should take a shower, like the likelihood of a missile at the time interrupting you in the shower.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, the greatest minds of the Jewish people are at work here.
Solving our most difficult challenges.
Yeah, but I mean, it's been utter chaos in my home. There's no school. My husband's off in reserve duty. I still have a job. Arguably, my job is more important at a time like this. I have been the Zoom concierge / lunch lady / everything else while also doing my job. You know, we gotta make time for the podcast.
My four-year-old said to me, he likes the Iranians. Why? Because every time there's a siren and we go down to the safe room, to the shelter, I let him play games on my phone. I don't usually let him play games on my phone. So he's very thankful to the Iranians because he gets lots of times to play video games on my phone. I guess everybody has their perspective.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think, well, my three-year-old every night asks me, he says he wants there to be a siren so that I come and sleep in his room because his room is the safe room.
I think a real question is, how long is this going to last? I think that's one of the questions that everybody is asking. Initially, President Trump talked about 4 or 5 weeks, but over the last few days, we've heard things like, we're moving ahead much more quickly, ahead of schedule, the war is nearly complete. And these comments, I think, are very, very impactful on the course of the war, because it seems to me that the strategy of the Iranian regime is to survive. Now, it knows that it can't stand up in the face of U.S.-Israeli combined military power. And it doesn't really even have its asymmetrical warfare capabilities that it relied on in the past, because its proxies, Hezbollah, Houthis, Hamas, have been so degraded by Israel and by the United States that that's not really an option either. And I think that's really been the main thrust of its strategy is, first of all, firing 3,000 or more projectiles, missiles, drones at Arab states, primarily in the GCC, so that those countries then turn to President Trump, the hope that those countries turn to President Trump and call on him to end the war because of the economic damage. The other interesting thing that I think what you're saying is that the foreign minister of Iran is basically channeling Tucker Carlson at this point. Just look at some of his recent tweets. Shedding of both American and Iranian blood is thus on Israel firsters. American people deserve better and should take back their country. I saw another tweet of his, he just put on a tweet about oil prices. Iran does not want to harm ordinary Americans who overwhelmingly voted against involvement in costly foreign wars, blamed for surging gas prices, costlier mortgages, and pummeled 401k ties lies squarely with Israel and its dupes in Washington, right? So it's basically their goal again here is to generate opposition, or the hope is to generate opposition among the Republican base to put pressure on Trump to end the war, because that's really their only chance of survival.
This reminds me a little bit of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is now rotting in hell. But
I think he survived ultimately. Yeah, I think his bodyguards were killed, but he...
Better luck next time.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was like around 8 years ago or so. Maybe he started tweeting about American football. I think it was the anniversary of Tupac's death. He started tweeting Tupac. And we were like, I was like, what exactly is he going for here? So at least the foreign minister of Iran is a little bit clearer what his goal is there. Although, you know, you said he's channeling Tucker Carlson. I think Tucker Carlson is channeling the Iranians. I mean, the rumor, the unconfirmed rumor was always that Tucker was on the payroll of the Qataris. But now he's even made the Qataris angry because he's spread this sort of unconfirmed, again, like just rumor that is not true, which is that the Qataris arrested a Mossad cell. And then the Qataris came out and they denied it. And I believe they had arrested Iranians, actually, in Qatar. So who knows who's paying him? Maybe it's Iran now because he's a lot more in tune with them.
I think this also ties into this discourse we've seen over the last few days about the cost of the war. And people are quoting this CSIS report that's talking about the cost being something like $900 million a day for the first 100 hours of the war. And obviously the war is quite costly, but people do have to take into account what's changing here. So we've seen the rate of fire of missiles and drones by Iran decrease by something like 92% since the peak on the first day of the war. The U.S., as there are less and less Iranian missiles, the cost of interception is going down. The cost of the munitions that the America and Israel, as they're moving from that standoff capability of firing precision missiles from far away to dropping laser or GPS-guided bombs from standing in, from close in, the cost of those munitions is going way down. So the overall cost is going down more and more. I think the critical element is, insofar as the President Trump and Israel communicate that this war is going to go on for as long as possible. First of all, it's going to take a while until we are really able to destroy the ballistic missile capabilities and the naval capabilities and the terror capabilities and the remnants of the nuclear program. But also, if the Iranian people come to the conclusion that that's it, the regime is over, they're much more likely to take back their country and to rise up. If they believe that the regime is going to survive and will take revenge against anybody who speaks up, they're much less likely to take that first step of rising up. I think, by the way, we heard Senator Graham call for the UAE and Saudi Arabia to become involved offensively. Again, if these countries believe that the Iranian regime is going to survive, that the war will end and they'll hang on, then they're much less likely to get involved because they don't want to attack and then be left with Iran as their neighbor. If they believe that this operation is going to go on for long enough to create the conditions for the Iranian people to take back their country, I think it's much more likely that they'll get involved as well.
Yeah, and that's the difference between the most recent messaging from President Trump versus that from Prime Minister Netanyahu. Netanyahu keeps saying, we're going to go all the way. He does say, ultimately, it's up to the Iranian people to rise up. But he says, you know, Israel's going to keep going till we get what we want out of this. And Trump, on the other hand, has been sending mixed signals, as you said. He said the day before we're recording this, so he said on Monday night that the war seems complete, but we can keep going. And then he sort of threatened Iran that if there's any funny business, if they block the Strait of Hormuz and all sorts of things like that, so then there will be even more powerful strikes than ever before. So really unclear what President Trump is thinking. And, you know, like you said, not so long ago, we were talking about this continuing past Passover. So that would be like another month.
Which would be not so much fun, especially for all the Pesach programs and tourism that are supposed to take place over Pesach. We actually have interesting dates coming up. On the 19th to 20th, we have Eid al-Fitr, the end of Ramadan. And probably on the 21st, we have Nowruz, the Persian New Year. And it'll be interesting to see how that also plays into the considerations. I would imagine that this is sort of the moment of the identification and pride of the Iranian people and their Persian culture and heritage. And they're going to look at this regime and say, okay, you are the reason why we're suffering so much, why we're not able to celebrate the holiday this year. And I hope that will encourage them to rise up as they have again and again, very heroically over the years. And we saw in January, there's a bit of a paradox because as long as the bombs are falling, then there's no possibility really for mass demonstrations. It's too dangerous. In essence, Israel and the U.S. will have to hold their fire, then see if the Iranian people, again, take to the streets, are able to come together, all the various factions and leaders and groups, and then decide, okay, if they do that, fantastic. And if not, Is it because they're unable to? Is it because there needs to be a further campaign against the IRGC and besiege and internal repression forces? But we won't know until the fire essentially pauses and the Iranian people have a chance to take action.
Right. And I think we've talked, and we've had guests who have talked about how hard it is to do regime change from the air. And I think also this talk coming from Trump is probably because they maybe running out of targets isn't exactly what's going on, but the airspace of Iran was divided between the U.S. and Israel, and they also just seem to be targeting sort of different kinds of targets, right? So like the U.S. has basically destroyed the Iranian Navy, while Israel's a lot more focused on Iran's air defenses and their missile launchers and things like that. So it seems like within their area of action, maybe what President Trump is saying is that, you know, they've taken out almost all the targets that they had designated before. But if you want to change the regime, which Trump doesn't use the phrase regime change, but on the other hand, he said that this is just the beginning of a new country, right? And he talks a lot about the Iranians needing to rise up. You need that extra push from the people. And then there was a really interesting op-ed in the New York Times, of all places, not something I often recommend, but about why actually there might need to be some boots on the ground. And they weren't talking about some sort of big invasion, but they were talking about the uranium, the enriched uranium. It's there in Iran somewhere, and you don't want bad actors to get their hands on it. And the best people to get their hands on it and dispose of it safely would be the U.S. And so it'll be interesting to see moving forward how they decide to handle that.
There's no doubt that whatever the outcome of whether it ends in a week or in 4 weeks from now, it's going to have a far-ranging impact, I think, on two areas that are really critical for Israel and Middle Eastern security. One is on Israel-U.S. cooperation. I think this is the most integrated bilateral military offensive in history in terms of the operational cooperation, the intelligence cooperation, the fusion of signals and of battlefield awareness and of logistics between Israel and the United States. I don't think there's any other example in history of two militaries cooperating so closely on an operation. This goes far beyond, for example, American and British cooperation in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And I think that'll have an important impact as Israel and the United States talk about, for example, what the next military MOU might look like, and this idea potentially of moving from foreign military financing to Israel to partnership, but also seeing the impact of the American investment in the Israeli Air Force. I think it'll have overall a very positive impact on that cooperation going forward. And the second area where I think it'll have a major impact is on the area of Middle East cooperation. The GCC countries are certainly going to be investing, even though the performance of their air defenses, their air force, has been quite impressive. The UAE is shooting down 99% of missiles, 94% of drones, but they're certainly going to be looking to increase that cooperation and integration in their capabilities. And I think that'll lead to further cooperation with Israel. We've already seen, where I'm hearing that there's growing interest in the overland IMEC trade route because of all the disruptions to sea shipping. And I think that'll develop further as a result of this war as well. And I think the United States, once it finishes dealing with Iran, they're going to want to return their focus to the Indo-Pacific. And a key element to making that happen is encouraging Israel and all of the United States' CENTCOM partners in the GCC and in the Middle East to work more closely together. So I hope and I expect the United States will really encourage that going forward.
You're talking about the Indo-Pacific. You know, if we talk about China, this war sort of helps or strengthens the U.S.'s case against China as well, because Iran is an important ally to China. China had been buying a lot of its oil from Iran. And so I've seen some articles saying that this war is about China, and I don't believe that. I really don't think that. But it doesn't hurt, you know? And so even those in the Trump administration who call themselves restrainers, where they say, we're not isolationists, but we want the focus to be wholly on sort of great power competition and on China, it serves a purpose there as well. I don't believe those people that think they're genuine, by the way. I think they are just isolationists, but that's a different story. If we take them at face value.
So we've talked about the regional and bilateral implications, but obviously the home front, the Israeli home front, is a key element of this as well. Lav, what do you think in terms of the resilience and the way the home front is standing up and handling this war as opposed to previous wars and in general?
I mean, for a country of people who are really are like rule breakers and question authority all the time, and people are being remarkably disciplined about following the rules. And I have to read the message from Magen David Adom from the Emergency Medical Services in Israel. This is the latest sort of casualty count as of when we're recording it. So when you guys listen to it, there might be more. But they said, Magen David Adom teams have provided medical treatment to 810 people, including 709 with physical injuries and 101 suffering from anxiety symptoms. So, okay, 709 people have gotten physical injuries as a result of missiles, okay? 12 fatalities, but then 541, okay, out of the 709, okay, so that's like a lot of people, it's very close to all of them, were injured while making their way to sheltered areas. So it's not people who are actually injured by the missiles, it's people who like fell down the stairs on the way to a bomb shelter or something like that. And then 9 were injured in traffic accidents when they were trying to stop because they heard a siren. So what I have to say to Iran, I mean, I'm not saying the missiles are nothing. Like, they're scary. Like, obviously, Israelis are doing a very good job of making their way to the shelters. And of the 12 fatalities, I think, like, at least a third of them are people who were not in shelters when they were supposed to be. But it's interesting to see Iran is putting a lot of money and a lot of effort, or the Islamic Republic is putting a lot of money and effort into shooting these missiles at Israel. And while it's, we're all suffering sort of mentally and the economy, the macro economy is not suffering, but the micro, I think people are suffering. It's having very little physical effect on people. And that comes in contrast, of course, with the anti-Israel propaganda you see online, like Tel Aviv is burning from George Galloway. You know, the really funny thing about this statement that went viral from George Galloway about Tel Aviv burning, which of course is not true. There's a handful of sites that missiles struck. And so like individual buildings or like a street that has a crater in it, which is, again, a bad thing. But from that to Tel Aviv is burning, like that's ridiculous. But you watch the statement and George Galloway says he knows it because he has friends in Tel Aviv. Then he goes on Schenken Street near Dizengoff Square. Schenken Street is not near Dizengoff Square. They do not intersect, for starters. But the other thing is, George Galloway, you know, we were both friendly with Alon Levy, who became the government spokesman for the first few months of the Gaza War. His original claim to fame when he was a college student is that he was supposed to debate George Galloway. And then when he mentioned in the debate that he's a dual citizen with Israel, George Galloway said, "Oh, I don't debate Israelis." And he walked off the stage. And that sort of went viral in early days of virality when that concept was new. And suddenly George Galloway has friends who live on Schenken Street. Like,
maybe it's Alon. Yes. Maybe Alon is updating him as to the massive destruction. George Galloway, I think, is a good example of people who essentially are disconnected from reality
should say, for those who aren't familiar, that he's a former British, I think former at this point, British member of parliament representing Bradford, which is a very heavily Muslim area. And he's just like a very extreme anti-Israel figure for, I don't know, like 20 years in the UK.
And sometimes you see Galloway, or you see other people, the Young Turks, or, you know, other people online who just, some of them are hardcore Hitler supporting anti-Semites. Some of them are just lunatics who are, you know, totally disconnected from reality, but who, you know, become viral and probably make a lot of money by, you know, pushing these conspiracy theories.
Well, you have a whole news site running on it, right? You have that Drop Site News, which is exactly, like, you know, conspiracy theory central. Everything that they say about Israel is just like utter nonsense.
So I had an ex post this week, a tweet, where I called on people, serious people from the pro-Israel community, not to appear on Piers Morgan's show. And the reason I made that call is, you know, anytime anybody says that they don't want to appear on Piers Morgan or they criticize him, says, "Oh, you're calling me an anti-Semite. Why does everybody think I'm an anti-Semite?" No, it's not. I don't know whether Piers Morgan is an anti-Semite. My guess is he's probably not an anti-Semite. But the entire point of his show, somebody recently described it as Jerry Springer, is to bring anti-Israel lunatics who are disconnected from all reality to scream at good faith, well-meaning people who support Israel. And you have these clips of the people screaming at each other. Obviously, nothing constructive ever happens. There's no contribution to understanding reality. And those anti-Israel wackos and Piers Morgan make a lot of money because they're platforming people like this, and they get a lot of clicks and a lot of likes, and they get high ratings. And that's how Piers Morgan makes a lot of money. Now, if that's what he wants to contribute to the world, fine, that's his business. But I don't think that serious pro-Israel people should help him with that. If he wants to just bring on Candace Owens and everybody and the Young Turks and everybody else to scream, let him do that. But I definitely think that serious people from the pro-Israel community should find other outlets and other platforms to present their views and should not go on Piers Morgan anymore.
Yeah, I saw your tweet, which did very well, great numbers. But my thought was, I agree, serious people shouldn't do it. There are some pro-Israel influencer types who I might define as less serious and who they too are there for clickbait. And I'm like, just leave it to them. They can hold their own because they're good yellers. They're not necessarily great with the facts or whatever. And that's the level that it deserves, you know? But like more serious people, even if they want attention for good reasons, right? To promote good things. I'm not saying like, you know, we all need some attention to advance our careers. it's just not worth it. It's really just not worth it.
Well, this week we have a very, very serious guest on the podcast, Professor Yaakov Jacob Nagel, the former head of Israel's National Security Council and the National Security Advisor to the Prime Minister. But before we get to Professor Nagel,
this is the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons podcast for anyone who wants to understand what's happening in the Middle East. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise to bring you fresh insights into the most critical issues facing Israel and the Middle East.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. We want to encourage you to send links to the podcast to your friends and post them on social media so we can keep coming back and doing this regularly. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And follow the Misgav Institute across all social media platforms. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center focused on strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation and integration, and its international alliances. And especially at this time of war and, frankly, a changing world order, I would encourage everybody to follow the Misgav Institute wherever you get your news. This week's guest is Professor Yaakov, or Jacob, Nagel, Israel's former National Security Advisor and head of the National Security Council. Professor Nagel has spent more than 40 years in key national security roles in the IDF, where he holds the rank of the Brigadier General in the Reserves, in the Defense Ministry, and in the Prime Minister's Office. Many of these roles connected to the most advanced military technologies in the world. Professor Nagel today heads the Center for Security Science and Technology at Israel's Technion University. He's also a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He recently headed two extremely important national commissions, one on the future of the IDF's budget and force buildup, looking ahead to the future battlefield, and a second on artificial intelligence and how Israel can ensure its leadership in the civilian aspects of AI. Professor Nagel served from 2016 to 2017 as Israel's National Security Advisor. Among his many other critical contributions was negotiating the MOU between Israel and the United States on military cooperation. From 2011 to 2015, he headed the Strategic and Defense Policy Directorate at Israel's National Security Council, playing a key role on many issues, including Iran. From 1996 to 2011, Professor Naga held various senior roles in the Defense Ministry's Directorate for Defense R&D, including leading the committee that made the decision to develop Israel's Iron Dome air defense system. In this conversation, we go in depth into all of the various aspects, both of the current war in Iran and the seven-front war that Israel's been fighting since October 7th, and the question of how technology is playing a role in reshaping the battlefield today and in the future. So without further ado, stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Yaakov Nagel. Professor Jacob Yaakov Nagel, thank you so much for joining Mideast Horizons.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I like your place, and it's okay. I like especially your manager. My successor, Meir Ben Shabbat, is a great guy.
He is a great guy, the chair of the Miskav Institute, Meir Ben Shabbat.
Even so, he's an MBS, Mohammed bin Salman or Meir Ben Shabbat, yes.
We're speaking as the Operation Roaring Lion and Epic Fury are ongoing at high intensity.
Yes.
In your view, in one sentence, what would a victory look like in Iran?
In one sentence, for such a very important question, you are really challenging me. But, you know, we have four main threats that Iran is posing on us that we have to take down. It's the nuclear, the missiles, the terror support, and the depression of the people. All four of them, we have to be removed, but it won't work for a long time unless a real victory is by making the Iranian people going to the streets and replacing their regime, their leadership. It cannot be done by U.S. or Israel. It must be done by the Iranian people. This is a real total victory. Now, sometimes you cannot get a total victory. You get a partial victory.
Do you think that the total victory is realistic? Is the opposition or the Iranian people prepared to do something like that from what you know?
I think it's realistic. It's not 100% achievable. The more President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu will continue speaking, talking, and working on the same theme and won't give up to pressures that will start for sure, being more and more and more while the operation will continue. The more time both countries have to achieve those four main goals that I just mentioned, nuclear, terror, missiles, depression, then it will be easier for the people of Iran to understand that the help President Trump promised them long time ago finally came, and they will go out. Now, of course, they are not going to go out before the war is done and before it's a ceasefire on the streets. The question is when Israel or United States or both will decide, okay, we are stopping the war for one day, we're stopping the fire for one day. The people of Iran, remember we told you the time will come, it came. Take it in your hands. Then the percentages of achieving the ultimate goal will be higher. It will never be 100%.
But it's a bit of a paradox, right? Because we won't really know whether or not the Iranian people are able to rise up and retake their country until the military campaign stops, right? Until we have some sort of ceasefire and the bombs are no longer falling.
I'm not saying ceasefire. I'm saying stop fire for one day. No ceasefire because we are not talking with the Iranians. No more. Well, remember, see what President Trump said. No more talking. No more ceasefire. Total surrender. This is his words. I didn't even anticipate he would come to this point, and he came to this point very, very fast. It's total surrender. Now, his assistant said total surrender, meaning when the Iranian forces will not have any more capabilities to fight. Everyone can define total surrender or total victory or total defeat, or you know, it's not a mathematical equation. So, yes, you will never know. In those work, I'm a technological, I'm a professor of Technion. I'm I am coming from the technology part of this world. When I develop a missile, I know if this missile will work or not. When you develop something that is politically connected to people decisions or people thoughts, it will never be a total guarantee. Never. If someone is giving you this answer, tell him, I said he's a liar.
So people have described this operation as an unprecedented level of cooperation between the U.S. and Israel. And we know that U.S. and Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump are speaking. So what do people not know about this cooperation? What do they not understand?
It's a very important question. As a matter of fact, I can talk about this answer about all of our Zoom meeting, but I will try to do it very short. It's connected to the goals that I just mentioned before, but it's really an unprecedented cooperation, but it's based on three achieved goals or three parts of these achievings. First of all, it's the operational capability. It's air. It's intelligence. I will come to intelligence in a little bit. It's air. It's intelligence. It's space. It's technology. It's communication. It's logistic support. Then it's the political capabilities, mostly the cooperation, as I said, with the United States that is really started in the June war, the 12 days war, first of all, agreement and then joining. And the third one, of course, is the intelligence capability. You know where I came from, it's not because I'm coming from, it's most, the most important one. It's really the most important and the very, very complicated one. And above all these three, there are one more. It's the technology. Now, things are, in order to do what Israel and the U.S. are doing now, especially I can talk about Israel, you know, I'm not an American. Things that we are doing now in this war, it's not something that someone dreamed about last week and boom, we have it. It's not. Some of it is science fiction. See what we did just for the surprise against this Iran leaders. We surprised them in the 12 days war. We started in a surprise attack. We killed a lot of the scientists, the leaders, the army, the navy, the RGC, the every, you know, sometimes two or three levels of command. And we did some for the leaders of the you know, the leaders of the Iranian leadership. And then 8 months later, like they didn't learn, and believe me, when the places they can learn, they learn. Again, they orchestrated, gathered together, all of them in an underground facility. And Israel, you know, relatively speaking, people are talking about 42nd, 40 leaders. It's no, I'm not sure it's 40 and 40, but, you know, it's passing the message. And of course, Khamenei among them and many others. Mujtaba Khamenei was injured. Believe me, if you are running an insurance company, I won't advise you to do any life insurance on his head. He was injured. He's now the new leader. So just someone ask how much time it will happen until you do the mistake and you will go away. So people told him, what do you mean technology? And I cannot talk about technology because I'm coming from the technological world. But it's AI, it's missiles, it's swarms, it's robotics, it's many, 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 many things. But it's mostly, as I said before, operational, political, and intelligence capabilities, all together, the cooperation between U.S. and Israel, as you said, unprecedented. It's never before. And when I say technology, and when I say science fiction, when I say it's really things that no one can even imagine, of course I cannot reveal them and talk about them. I'm not talking about people, wow, Israel took over the cameras in Tehran. Even the beepers, believe me, the real technology achievements, the real technology overwhelming capabilities are much, much, much behind those things that I just mentioned and went out to the press. And maybe in 20, 25 years, we can talk about them. I'm sure some of them, we are not going to talk even in 25 years. And in some of them, it's 15 years, 15, sometimes 20 years. Believe me, I was there. 15, 20 years, thousands of man years in the Israel Air Force, the Israel industry, the DDR&D, all those organizations that build all those capabilities for 15, 20 years, and of course the intelligence, 8200 and all the other organizations, IDF, Mossad, all the crazy things that you can just imagine.
So going back to the sort of decisions that Israel has to make about Iran, I mean, things are going very well so far. We're talking about on day 10. But what mistakes do you think Israel needs to look out for at this point? And what does it need to avoid?
You know that the Israelis are never doing mistakes, but I'm joking. Yes, mistakes can happen, then have to learn from mistakes. This is the most important thing, that we're doing mistakes. Every time when I teach my students how to do R&D, this is my main course in Technion, I'm teaching them, if you didn't fail in tests, meaning your system was nothing, you have to fail sometimes. Now, some mistakes can be if we'll come to, you know, to we'll enter the euphoria, the thing that everything will go away well. And time will come also that Israel and the U.S. will have disagreements on many, many things. It's, the more time will go, especially when we come to a decision when we came to the point that we can declare total surrender or victory, or we don't want, believe me, the U.S. won't do it again for the next, I don't see this gathering of the beautiful armada of ships and airplanes, and yes, also the F-22, but believe me, it's the most the least important one. But it will come the time that we'll have to decide what we achieved and what is the next steps. Now, we have to make sure that we're not doing a mistake of stopping too early or too late. Because the more you're waiting, the more you're open to mistakes that can happen. Sometimes not because of you, but when you are in a war, mistakes can happen. And I don't want to have even a bit of a daylight between Israel and the U.S. And this is the situation today. I'm not sure it will be forever. So the biggest mistake that we can do is to stop too early or too late. Now, don't ask me when to stop, because if I would know, I can gamble and make a lot of money. And it really depends on what will happen now, what will happen in the northern part of Israel, what will happen with the thing that, you know, this war is shaping the world. You know, see the Gulf countries, see the modest Sunni countries that just are starting to understand who are the bad guys and who are the good guys. See the Hezbollah that just felt to the all that they dig to themselves. Don't believe that they are trying to talk to us of a ceasefire or not. Never mind if they are doing it or not. Doesn't matter. They did mistakes, especially today, for the first time in this war, they fired the PGMs, the precise guided munitions, to the center of Israel. So Israel will have to do things. Now again, even in Lebanon, we can do mistakes or not. Again, I don't want to go into too much details, but people are talking about 10 kilometers of security stripe, or up to the Litani, or even maybe more. Some crazy people are talking about conquering Lebanon. I'm not talking about it. It's not in my book, in my textbook. But we have to make sure that we are not doing those mistakes around us. And I hope that some of the countries that I just mentioned, the UAE just did one attack on the desalination facility in Iran.
Interesting, though, although the UAE has denied it pretty strongly.
I'm not part of the UAE government. I heard it in the communication. I didn't talk to anyone there. If it's yes or no, I don't know. But they will have to look. Iran attacked them hundreds, maybe thousands of times. You know, I have the numbers, but if you add UAVs, drones, ballistic missiles, and others on UAE only, you are more than 1,000 attacks. You cannot stay. What do you say to your people? Okay, I will wait for them to do more. You have to retaliate. You don't have to count on Israel, on the US. Otherwise, you'll come out as weak. You cannot. Same for the Saudis, same for the Kuwaitis, for the Bahrainis. Even Turkey was attacked. You know, the Iranians said it was a missile that was aimed to the American. I'm not in the excuse part now. So all of those countries understands what's going on. But still, other crazy partners can join and suffer. The Houthis, others. I don't know where it will, come from now on. The Europeans are asking questions. They are always on the sidelines. They like to do it. They are doing all the mistakes they can do. So, yes, we have to make sure that we are avoiding mistakes that will cost us the achievements of the war. And that it can happen.
There's a lot to unpack there, but I need to go back to your previous answer. And the global tech conversation over the last, certainly 2 or 3 years, has been entirely dominated by AI. Can you tell us a little bit more about how AI is changing the battlefield?
No. I can tell you that is a lot of influence. Some of the things, of course, are classified. Believe me, I can tell you one thing. Israel belongs to this country that AI will never do a decision in the battlefield. AI will not fire even one bullet. AI is a system that helps the warriors in the field. What I can say and what was revealed, the biggest achievement, the biggest support that AI gave you, especially in the intelligence world, is just to unfold and to digest the unimaginable size of data coming from all the sensors. Satellite, Vizint, SIGINT, it's crazy numbers.
And I assume that's in the planning stage, but also in real time, sort of battlefield awareness.
First of all, gathering the data, unfolding it, going over it, marking all the important things, and put some recommendations to the planners. No decision making. We call it decision aiding mechanism and systems. They are not taking any decisions, the AI system. Believe me, not even one single decision. They are giving you all the guidelines for the decisions that you can take. And of course, I cannot go into too many details of what AI is involved, especially in weapons and in weaponry and other things. But the thing that I can talk about that are unfolded is that, yes, I grew up in the intelligence many, many years ago. My system would never be able to, I wasn't the technological part of the intelligence. Our systems 30 years ago, 20 years ago, could never use or deal with such amounts of data. We just had to leave it alone. Also now, we cannot go over of all this data. But we have a real wide and wild world of data and intelligence that can be used in order to make sure that you are doing your job. And we, of course, are sharing, coming back to the unprecedented cooperation between Israel and the U.S., for example, is sharing of intelligence for both sides.
What do you think Israel needs to do to be a world leader in AI? I mean, maybe it already is, but...
I just finished a few months ago to lead the Israeli AI committee that the Prime Minister nominated me. And it was, I added the Nagel Committee on the Defense Budget for the next decade. It was defense-related committee with 12 great members of my committee. And then I was nominated to another committee of the AI leadership of Israel for the next years. Only it was on the civilian part of the AI, because the military have its own and we didn't want this committee to be classified. And yes, Israel needs to do a lot of things. The amazing thing is that I don't recall in the Israeli history two committees that most of the recommendations were adapted so fast. The AI committee recommendations, beside the amount of the budget, always it is the last one that is there. There is a budget, but 3 months after we put the recommendation on the government table, they created the AI body and, personalities inside the PM office. 25 people ran by Brigadier General retired Erez Askal. We have a lot of work now running in the AI. What I like always is to put a recommendation, step back. I don't want to be part of the, making it work. It's not, I used to be. It used to be my speciality, and now I am in the best place that a Jew is sitting, is giving advices, and then go back. So it's working again for the defense budget. Of course, the war took 1 year more, and now is another war. But most of the recommendation, all of the manpower recommendation, many other recommendations from our defense budget committee, were adopted. Most of them.
But AI is a very broad topic, from a huge arena. Where do you think Israel has the most potential for being a world leader? What types of AI, what areas of AI?
You have to differentiate between the, the defense world and the civilian world. It's very important not only to say in what areas you are a leader, but also in what areas you are not involved, because otherwise you are not concentrated and you are losing. For example, our committee advised not for Israel, not to try to be the next TSMC of Taiwan. We are not going to build a few billions of dollars of chips industry in Israel. But it's not just by a mistake that NVIDIA and Meta and Elon and others are opening huge. I hope it will stop the alarm, but we'll wait.
Well, maybe we should just tell our listeners, because they're going to hear this, that that's a pre-siren warning.
At least,
so there may or may not be a siren after that.
Let's see if it will be a warning or it will be a siren or not.
Yes.
So what we are doing again is we recommended that Israel will be, because we are number one in the world on the planning, on the taking the chips that someone will give you, or you buy, of course. No one is giving you, and making the planning, we have the best planners, the best AI adapters, the best. It's exactly the same as we did in our weapon systems. You know, I belong to the people that think that closing the Lavi, the Israeli air fighter, many, many years ago, was one of the best decisions Israel did. Why? Because if we do it, we had the best fighter, and we would have anything else. We decided that we are going to get or buy the main platforms mostly from the United States, and we are building the subsystems, air-to-air missile, air-to-ground missile, communication, electronic warfare, signal, all of them. So we are getting the F-15, the F-35, the F-16s, all the others, and we are making them the best planes in the world. This is exactly in AI. We should not try to be Taiwan because it's too big on us. Not everyone agreed with me, but this was the recommendation that was adopted by my committee. Still, we say that the most important thing in AI is manpower, and manpower is academy. So the biggest chunk of money that we needed is to make sure that we have the high-power computers, the 30 to 40 to 50,000 GPUs. It's small. You know, UAE, Saudis, they have 500,000. We don't have this money. But we need 30, 40,000 chips, GPUs, computer, so the academy can make sure that we have the 700 core AI people that will teach the next generation of the 3,000, that will teach the 30,000, that will make sure that all the 300,000 will use. This is AI. It's all, you have to be in all levels. There is one level that we recommended not to be. This is in the chip area. Okay, all the others, Israel could be, and it still be, among the three leaders in the world. This is what's happening now. And I'm really glad that this recommendation was adopted. Still, we don't have this computer yet. The money is on its way. I am believing in what the Prime Minister and what the Treasury Minister said. Even so, afterwards, these people tried to tell him, no, we can rent, no counting on anyone else, someone that will rent me and then will close me. It should be owned, run by Israeli authorities, 30, 40, half of it, and more of it to the academy and to the startups, so we can be the leaders in this part of the world. Again, it's not connected to this war. It's not part that will work on this war. It's the continuation of Israel. It's not always what our committee was centered with in the civilian part of the AI. There is a big chunk of defense AI that I cannot elaborate too much. You got from me before much more than what I meant to tell you. And I hope no one will have to kill me afterwards.
Well, in a different area, the cooperation between Israel and the U.S., you were in charge of the Israeli side of negotiations for the last MOU. What do you think about what Netanyahu said, that the aid needs to go down to zero and it needs to be cooperation instead? Do you agree with that? And what do you think that cooperation would be?
You want me to go against my prime minister? What I think about it, I told my prime minister in private. I am writing about it. I'm advising who wants to get my advices. I signed on behalf of Israel the MOU 2016 of $38 billion. Believe me, when we started, people told me no more than 20. It will never happen. The U.S. won't give it to you. Also, people now are saying, again, it's not the same U.S., it's not the same president, it's not the same party even. But I belong to those that say you have to try. The most problematic is that someone tell you no. And I think that I'm starting to convince.
All right, I have a siren. So
where you are in Israel?
I'm in Modi'in.
Modi'in, okay, I'm in Rosh Ha'ain, so it's much, much better place. Move to Rosh Ha'ain.
Okay. All right, keep the conversation going. Don't worry about me.
No, what I'm saying is about the MOU. I think that there are ways to eat the cake and leave it untouched. But it's not something that I'm going to open in this conversation. I'm giving my advices to those that want to listen to them. And at the end, there is a prime minister. There is the leader of the negotiating team. There is a team. I'm advising who want to listen to my advisors, and almost all want to listen to my advisors. They can work according to my advice. Maybe I'm wrong. There are others that advised. Some of them are very good friends of mine. In this case, they are mistaken. I don't want to put names here, but ask Mayor Ben Shabbat. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. Who is doing the mistakes, but I'm sure that the prime minister will do what is needed for the country, the state of Israel.
Are there areas where you say we should really expand our cooperation with the United States? And in the framework of the next MOU, a key goal should be expanding our cooperation in this area or this.
Just read what is written in the three pages of the MOU in my defense budget committee. And it's written there very, very simple. It's written there, the next MOU is not going to be the same as the old one. First of all, no OSP. All the money will be spent in the U.S. All the money will bring work jobs for the Americans. All the money will go only for main platforms. We did mistakes in the previous MOUs. We spent money on oil or other things. All the money have to go to F-15s, F-16s, refuelers, helicopters, ammunition for the ground and the air, some ground vehicles, and that's it. Until when we come to this, no money will stay. Remember that half of the next MOU that people want to give up, already we signed contracts on. So if we don't have the MOU, we have to take this money from the budget that is already squeezed, and already the Minister of Defense need much more than what was before. And Prime Minister Netanyahu and the government already decided, and it's almost the same as our committee recommended. Remember, they said about 350 billion shekel addition. Remember that 100 of this 350 comes from internal resources, 50 from working much better, you know, saving, 50 will come from selling assets, and the other 250 from addition. It's exactly what we wrote in our committee. 100 that was before, and 133 that we added. So instead of 233, the government now make it 250 and plus 100. So it's almost the same. I'm not saying it will go on the same areas that we recommended in my commission because things happen, things change. And I say again, all we talked was before the last war. Believe me, talking now about with US about MOU after this great cooperation between Israel and US, it will be very, very natural to talk about MOU because the Americans understand that the planes that Israel bought using this FMF money help the US. Because if Israel didn't have these planes, US have to send more. The same for weapons, not ground forces because they are not using ground, but all the air power that we are working now together. If Israel doesn't have it, the US have to put more. So Israel is the front. We are not part of the US, but we are the front line in the Middle East for the US forces. We are helping. We are working back to back. It's amazing just to see the cooperation between US and Israel. It will be much easier to sign a new great MOU after this war.
If I could just ask one last question. You talked about the changing environment after this war, and that's also at least a weakened Iran, if not a new government in Iran. I want to ask you about Turkey. Turkey has a very strong military. We have conflicting interests in Syria and other arenas. Could you foresee a military conflict between Israel and Turkey in the next 5-10 years?
Don't you think that we have enough problems without Turkey? Now, why I'm saying so? Because I wrote two lines in my defense budget committee, and these two lines became, wow, a big headlines. And everyone really, really took it out of proportion. After October 7, we wrote the same two lines about Egypt, and no one paid attention. Egypt and Turkey. They are not part of our threat assessment because otherwise our budget would be much bigger and other. It's not that because we don't want them to be our enemies. But still, after October 7, no more taking risks. We have to manage the risks. Now, we have to, what we wrote in our recommendation, Turkey, Egypt, pay attention. Put Intel view, not too much. Make sure that you see the, you know, if changes are coming, it's a country. It's not something that can happen from the day tomorrow. It can, but no more saying it cannot happen. But what we said, pay attention. Don't neglect. That's it. And then people wrote as the headline, the Jacob Nagel, one of Netanyahu best allies and advisors said we have to be prepared for a war with Turkey. We never said so. We don't want a war. We don't want Turkey as an enemy. We are not going to have Turkey as a friend while Erdogan is still the leader. Believe me, I was the head of the technological cooperation between Israel and Turkey between 2000 and 2004. When I was traveling to Turkey, I was treated there like a king or a Caesar or I don't know what. It changed when Erdogan came. It will change again when you will go out. And we don't want them as an enemy. They are a very important country in our area. Still, they want to be involved in Syria. They want to take part in Gaza, and Netanyahu is standing very, very firm not to allow them to be part in the Gaza solutions. In Syria, believe me, we are not going to allow them to be part. Again, In the parts of Syria that are very connected, very close to Turkey border, they can do whatever they want with the Kurds, with others. But not in Damascus, not in our borders. Israel cannot allow it. We did some of those mistakes in the past. One of the biggest changes that our committee recommended, and Israel exactly is doing it in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, other, is that no more containment and defense. The two words that are running towards in the past, containment, defense, peace, at any cost. Today, it's prevention, attack. Peace is very important, not at any cost. It's exactly the biggest change from before October 7 and after. And it's affecting also the war now in Iran. Preemptive strike. We did twice. Not giving anyone to dictate you what to do, when to do, and when to stop, and when to start. This is exactly the meaning of changing the Israel national security strategy, what Netanyahu led. We started it in 2017-18 when he wrote the national security strategy, and then Meir came after and finished it. As many people added to it and changed, but people said, people that try to undermine what Netanyahu did. Believe me, this is exactly the change. Yes, everyone did mistakes. Everyone. I'm thinking myself. I'm not saying everyone. Everyone was, sorry. Jacob Nagel and others around me, we were sure that the Hamas is deterred, the biggest problem is in from Lebanon, not from the Hezbollah and Radwan, not from the Nukba. We had mistakes. No more mistakes. We cannot take this mistake again. That's it. If we did it, we suffered one of the worst, maybe the blackest days of Israel history. We cannot allow ourselves to do it again. So, yes, no more taking risks. Managing the risk, yes.
Professor Yaakov Nagel, thank you so much for joining Mideast Horizons. And thank you so much for that, everything you've done for Israel's national security over the last 40 years and the contribution you continue to make. Thank you. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be with you. And I'm sure that we will continue talking in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav at www.misgavims.org and on all the big social media platforms. And you can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com. We'll see you next time.